Good afternoon, everyone, or good morning, depending on your location. I'm Dan Schwartz from Seyfarth Shaw. Before we get started, I have to read a little disclaimer, so bear with me as I read through this. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw LLP for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Questions can be submitted anytime throughout the presentation via the web conferencing tool. If we do not answer them right away, we will try to address your question after the presentation. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the login information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Okay, with that out of the way, as I mentioned, I am Dan Schwartz. I am a partner in our Chicago office, and you'll see up on the slide your three presenters for today. With me, who you will hear from shortly, is Brian Michaelis, the head of our IP department in our Boston office, and then also Jim McNary in our Sacramento and also in our San Francisco offices will be focusing on some of the trade secret considerations today. We intend to cover over the next hour a variety of different questions regarding patents and trade secrets and where they intersect with each other. We've bullet pointed the particular areas that we are anticipating covering, including what is a patent and what information is patentable, what is a trade secret and what information qualifies for trade secret protection, the pros and cons of patent versus trade secret protection, and then conversely, what information or technology may best be protected through both trade secret and patent protection. And then throughout the presentation, there will be a couple of references to the new patent reform legislation, which is called the American Invents Act, and how the new patent reform legislation may impact the decision of whether to seek patent and or trade secret protection. So that's what we're going to go over. The format is going to be kind of an introduction to patents and trade secrets, and then we are going to delve into two different fact scenarios, hypothetical fact scenarios, that we will use to highlight and address the issues and considerations regarding seeking patent protection, trademark protection, or both or neither, as the case may be. So with that background, we'll go to slide three. The first bullet point there is meant to make the point that why it's important for any company to take protecting its intellectual property seriously. And this is just some data from 2007, and rest assured it is likely increased. So the ABA estimates that U.S. businesses lose approximately $59 billion annually due to IP theft. And so if you think that it is not important to address the concerns regarding your intangible assets, your intellectual property, these hard and fast numbers would suggest that everybody needs to take this seriously. There are generally four types of intellectual property rights when we talk about IP theft above. There are patents, copyrights, trademarks, and trade secrets. We're going to focus, obviously, on patents and trade secrets here today because those are the only two that protect ideas. And we'll get into what the ideas are and what ideas comprise and how you go about protecting them. Copyright and trademark protect other forms of intellectual property, but the ones that protect ideas, inventions, processes, manufacturers, those are things covered by patents and trademarks. Notably, and as we'll get into in some detail, patents and trade secrets can can be used to complement each other in the life cycle of any intellectual property or any new invention. They can simultaneously exist for the same invention. And in fact, in many instances, an invention or an idea, as it is first created and conceived, will initially be, just by operation of its existence, a trade secret. And it will remain so, potentially, until there is a decision to seek patent protection, and whether or not that patent actually issues covering the invention will impact whether or not it continues as both a trade secret and a patentable invention, or morphs into one or the other. We'll get into some of those issues as we go through this. Next slide, please. Okay. So generally, what is a patent? As I said before, it generally protects, or not generally, it does protect ideas, new and useful ideas, new and useful inventions. I've excerpted the relevant part of the patent laws, 35 U.S.C. Section 101, and highlighted the relevant information. Whoever invents or discovers any new and useful, what? Any new and useful process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter, or any new and useful improvement thereof, may obtain a patent, therefore, subject to the conditions in the rest of the patent rules. So, when I say ideas and inventions, what we're talking about are new and useful processes, new and useful machines, new and useful articles of manufactures. You may have in front of you a computer mouse. You know, something, the mouse itself is an article of manufacture. And, quite frankly, the relevant components of that mouse are also articles of manufacture. Compositions of matter. There are many patents in the chemical and pharmaceutical space that you may have read about that cover the composition of chemical structures, chemical materials, and in fact, we'll have one of our examples that talks a little bit about that. And improvements on any of these. So the fact that Henry Ford came up with the first way to put internal combustion engines into an automobile, that doesn't mean that every new invention to the internal combustion engine that went in a car somehow is blocked because something came before. All new improvements, as long as they're new and useful, are patentable subject matter. The next bullet point, patents do not give you the right or authority to do anything, and that's a common misconception among about patents. If you are able to obtain patent protection, the only thing that you are able to do is to prevent others from practicing your invention. So as you can see, below that I've excerpted 35 U.S.C. 271A, except as otherwise provided in this title, whoever without authority does what? Makes, uses, offers to sell, or sells any patented invention within the U.S. or imports it into the U.S., any patented invention, infringes the patent. So if you obtain patent protection, it doesn't necessarily give you the right to do anything, but it does give you the right to exclude others from practicing your invention, to prevent others from using your invention. It's a simple example. To go back to the car, if you had a new invention on the motor, it doesn't give you the right to go make a car because there might be other issues, other intellectual property that other people own that would prevent you from doing so. Next slide, please. The quid pro quo in obtaining a patent, and this will become one of the issues that is really contrasted with trade secrets, is the disclosure requirement. Those of us who practice patent law talk about the quid pro quo, meaning the compromise between the government and the entity seeking patent protection. The government says, we'll give you a government-granted right to exclude others for practicing your invention, as long as you tell the world all about your invention. So in order to obtain patent protection, you have to disclose essentially everything you know about your invention to the world. What you get in exchange for that, as I mentioned, is the government-granted right to exclude, and that government-granted right lasts 20 years from the date of filing. You'll see some distinctions between this and the trade secret side shortly. That quid pro quo, that disclosure requirement, is statutorily discussed in 35 U.S.C. Section 112. And Brian's going to talk a little bit more about some of the details, but in general, there's what's called the specification of the patent, in which you tell the world, you disclose to the world everything that you know about your invention. And there are generally three requirements to that specification. One, you've got to provide a written description of the invention that basically tells the public, puts on notice, what it is that you believe your invention to be. Second of all, it has to enable, that disclosure has to enable one of skill in the art to make and use that invention. What does that mean? It means if it's a pharmaceutical patent covering a new drug, that doesn't mean that any old person can pick up that patent and read it and understand it and be able to practice it. But people who are in that field would understand and know how to use and make and practice the invention based on the disclosure in the patent. And then finally, and there might be there are some questions about this in light of the new act, but there is still most assuredly a best mode requirement in which, as the inventor, you need to disclose in your patent application the best mode that you know, if you have one, of practicing your invention. So that's kind of what's in a patent from the higher level and some of the higher level views of this. Brian, I'm going to turn it over to and have him kind of walk through some more of the details on the patent side. Brian?
Okay, thank you, Dan. Next slide, please. Okay, so what is in a patent? We're going to walk through a patent fairly quickly here, but generally in this slide, I just outline the major parts of a patent. It contains drawings that provide technical disclosure. There's a little bit of background in most patents that talks about the state of the prior art or what is known and sometimes the problems with the prior art. There's almost always a summary of the invention, and there's a detailed description of the invention, sometimes called a description of the preferred embodiment of the invention. The drawings and the detailed description largely make up the technical disclosure and satisfy that quid pro quo that Dan alluded to earlier, whereby the patentee, in order to get that exclusive right, has to tell the world how to make and use the invention for which the patent is sought. And then in the patent also there are what we call claims of the patent. They are at the end of the patent typically, and always actually, and they are really like in a deed, a property right. They define the meets and bounds of that property right, of this intellectual property right, and specifically the right to exclude others. So we'll rip fairly quickly through a patent. Next slide, please. Okay, here you see just some of the figures of a fairly simple, straightforward invention. Next slide, please. These are the drawings of the invention that provide part of the technical disclosure. And if you notice from the drawings, there are reference numbers. Those reference numbers in the detailed description help the patentee describe the invention in its detail and, again, satisfy the quid pro quo requirement or provides a disclosure that enables one skilled in the art to make or use the invention. Next slide, please. And the patent comprises text. Here you see the summary of the invention. You'll see at the top of this particular patent, column 1 and column 2, and down along column 1 you see a summary of the invention, as I alluded to earlier, and then part of the way down column 2 begins the detailed description of a preferred embodiment. And this section, the detailed description section, again, satisfies the quid pro quo and is largely what satisfies 112.1 that Dan alluded to earlier. Enables one skilled in the art to make and use the invention, provides that written description, and hopefully somewhere in there sets forth the best mode of the invention. Next slide, please. Now, the claims here that may be difficult for you to see on this screen here are typically at the end of the patent. They are, again, what define the right to exclude. It's a series of paragraphs of sorts that are enumerated, and number one claim here, for example, claim one, has sub-elements A, B, C, and D, and this is what we fight about in the context of patent litigation. The first thing we tend to fight about is what the claims mean, because by determining what the claim language means, and a judge determines that, you can determine the scope of the patent, and then once the claims are properly construed, that is, the meaning of the claim terms determined, those properly construed claim terms can be applied to an accused product to determine whether or not that accused product infringes that patent claim. Next slide, please. So how do we get this patent? Well, we get the patent by filing an application with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. The patent application has the parts that I mentioned and that we just walked through. A patent examiner at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office gets the application and then performs searches on the applications that are in that examiner's queue, if you will, typically on a first-in, first-out basis. So the application sits there for a little while, the examiner picks it up, does a search, and then issues what we know as a patent office action. And now we're engaged in what we call, and is commonly referred to as, patent prosecution. So the office, patent office that is, issues an office action, typically rejecting the claims based on some form issues relating to the claims and sometimes to the application, but almost always there's a rejection based on the prior art. Prior art is patent or previous patents or publications or things that are known in the art area to which the patent relates that are used to establish from the patent office's perspective that a patent should not issue. Typically the rejections based on prior art are under 35 U.S.C. section 102, where the patent office tells us that the invention is not novel, that is, it's not a new invention, it's something that's known before and can be seen from one reference or one piece of prior art. We also see rejections based on the invention or the patent office's view that the invention is obvious in view of some combination of references. Typically two or more references will be applied in a rejection and the patent office will say you can't have those claims that you'd like on what you think is your invention because it would be obvious to combine these two references. So after that rejection or set of rejections are received from the office in an office action, we'll respond to that office action by either amending the claims and or presenting arguments over the prior art to overcome those rejections. If we're successful, ultimately, we receive a notice of allowance, the patent issues. The reality of the process is it takes years. In some cases, it may be as quick as 18 months, but typically it's going to be more than a year and bordering on 2 years before a patent issues. And in the process, you've disclosed the invention, and you can contrast that to what we'll talk about with respect to trade secrets in a little bit. So the fact that we have to do this disclosure, the fact that it takes as long as it does to get a patent, requires that we consider, you know, long and hard what we're going to pursue patent protection on. Next slide, please. Generally, as Dan talked about earlier, processes, machines, manufacturers, compositions of matter, and improvements thereof, but we need to be discriminating in terms of what we want to get a patent on. If it's something that isn't going to be in the market or provide us a competitive advantage for, you know, 2 years or less, it's something that we probably don't want to seek patent protection on because, again, it's going to be a couple of years before you get a patent out of the Patent and Trademark Office. So longer product life cycle developments are more appropriate for seeking patent protection. Obviously, it has to be something or should be something that will or does provide a competitive advantage in the market that you're in or going into with that product. Generally, you'd like to seek patent protection on aspects of a development that are readily discernible by a user or by the public, or can be easily reverse engineered. The fact of the matter is, the patent provides the only way to protect those mechanisms, and you'll see later as we discuss it that trade secrets aren't appropriate in the context where reverse engineering is easy. So if something is easy to reverse engineer or is readily discernible, that's a better candidate for patent protection than something that might be easily maintained as a trade secret for an indefinite period of time. Next slide, please. So what can you do when you have a patent? Basically, it allows you to go out and sue people. You can try to exclude people from that area that you believe your patent covers, as defined by the claims that we talked about earlier. The remedies that are available are lost profits or a minimum of a reasonable royalty. The patent statute provides for enhanced damages in exceptional cases, and that can be up to three times the patentee's actual damages. There's a provision in the statute that provides for attorney's fees as well. And you can get an injunction, a forward-looking injunction, that precludes people from, or the defendant in the infringement case, from infringing that patent or continuing to infringe that patent. The patent you get and that you take to court to try to exclude others is presumed valid, and you get a ribbon copy from the government that's pretty impressive to juries in many cases, and comes with a presumption that is difficult to defeat in many cases. The burden, the defendant's burden to prove invalidity is a very high burden of clear and convincing evidence. That's as against the patentee's burden of proving infringement merely by a preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not. So the high burden that's attached to this patent that's presumed valid can be a valuable right and used to attempt to exclude others from the marketplace. Next slide, please. Okay, so Jim, I'll turn this over, I guess, at this point to Jim McNary, who's going to talk a bit about trade secrets and somewhat contrast those to the patent right that I just talked about. Jim?
All right. Thanks very much, Brian. Looks like the slide that we have left here is our parting cartoon about the inevitability of a patent attorney being invented. So a little humor to lighten things up before we get into trade secrets. Next slide, please. So one of the things that we're going to be doing in talking about trade secrets is doing some compare and contrast with patents. And one of the things that has already been alluded to by Brian and Dan is the fact that in some respects, trade secrets are polar opposite to patents in as much as you must keep them secret in order to maintain their viability. And why they're important is lost competitive advantage. If you do disclose a trade secret to the public, it can be fatal. You may lose your trade secret status. Trade secrets protect serious business assets in the hundreds of millions of dollars for a single trade secret. So lost revenues are a serious concern. If organizations don't take seriously their opportunity to protect trade secrets, they could be, in future litigation, susceptible to arguments that there's an institutional problem here, that there's a custom and practice of not taking reasonable measures to protect the trade secret. For those jurisdictions, like California, where I'm sitting, there is a very high presumption and bias in favor of the right to employment and employee mobility. And one of the things that helps moderate that in some respects is while employees are free to come and go as they please, they certainly can't go if they're going to take trade secrets. They can leave, but they just can't take the trade secrets. And so there are various means by which California employers can use to tether trade secret use to a former employee's new employment just to make sure that they are appropriately minding their obligations to the former employer. Next slide, please. So what is a trade secret? It need not be novel or unique. There is no registration that is to be filed. In fact, the opposite is true. We want to keep a trade secret absolutely secret. It's not published, and more than one person can possess it. Next slide, please. The Uniform Trade Secret Act. There is no federal Uniform Trade Secret Act, but it is an act that has been adopted by the vast majority of states. This is somewhat of a moving number because I think it's the New Jersey legislature that for the last 15 years, every year, has introduced the Uniform Trade Secret Act to be adopted, and they keep rejecting it. But the 46 out of 50 states have adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And so it provides some uniformity as far as the body of law and the requirements to constitute a trade secret, to protect it, and how one goes about litigating it. In some jurisdictions, the Trade Secret Act preempts common law claims, both common law claims that relate to trade secret itself and other claims, unfair competition, for example, or conversion are examples of claims that in some jurisdictions are preempted by the Act. Next slide, please. This is the California example, the definition of what a trade secret is, and this is very similar to the many other jurisdictions that have adopted it. So it's information that derives independent economic value, actual or potential, from generally not being known to the public or persons who can obtain economic value from it, and is subject to reasonable efforts under the circumstances to maintain its secrecy. Next slide, please. And just breaking this down a little bit, information, so it's got to have economic value, and from generally not being known to others, that is, it must be kept a secret, and that's, again, kind of the inverse of patent protection, where one must publish to be awarded the government-granted monopoly, and is subject to reasonable efforts to keep it secret. And we'll talk a little bit more about these, but this last one is really, really important. Next, please. Examples of information. This is a non-exclusive list, to be sure, but formulas, manufacturing processes, blueprints, engineering drawings, software, databases, business and marketing plans, detailed customer lists, customer information, financial information, detailed pricing metrics, rebating. That financial information that is not made public but which has value from not being known and would be valuable, for instance, to a competitor. Next slide, please. So it's got to be valuable. It's got to be independently, economically valuable, and it has to be actual at the time or potential. And so you could go through and otherwise meet the definition of a trade secret, but if what you're keeping secret really has no use or value presently or in the future, in terms of being economically valuable, that's one of the prongs that will cause you to not have a trade secret. Next slide, please. Not generally known. This is an important one in as much as it's not known to the public, and that's often easily met, but in the parens here, including those knowledgeable in the subject matter. So if what you're attempting to protect as a trade secret, let's say in the nanotechnology realm, is also known by your competitor down the street because they're skilled in the art. They have that same information. You may not, in fact, have a trade secret on your hands. And then, secondly, from someone who can obtain economic value from disclosure or use of that subject matter. Next slide, please. So what are reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy? There are several, but by far, in most jurisdictions, the leading indicator is a confidentiality agreement. That's not bulletproof. It's not going to ensure that one has taken reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy, but it certainly is a very good start. Other measures, password protection, email and electronic data policies, confidentiality reminders. To take action against any security breaches, I alluded to that when we first started, regular training on policies, exit interviews, and documentation. And I won't dwell on this, but increasingly, it's incredibly important for employers to have very good, very tight, appropriately drafted computer usage policies. I would say in 90% of the misappropriation lawsuits that I've been involved in over the last handful of years, the avenue by which the alleged misappropriator took the alleged trade secret information was through a computer, an external thumb drive, emailing the information to oneself from an email account at work to an email account at home. And if there aren't policies in place that prohibits clearly that conduct, you can have some problems. And you can also cut yourself off from having another claim available to you. For instance, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, or under California's Penal Code, Section 502, which is kind of a California analog to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Next slide, please. So this is a slide that I like to use just in a comical way, emphasize the point. Got to keep it secret. And this ties into, actually, believe it or not, some case law, recent case law in California that helps drive home the point. Next slide, please. Again, just underscoring the importance of really needing to keep the information confidential. Next slide. So misappropriation, this is, again, from California's statute, but is very similar in the many other jurisdictions that have adopted UTSA. So it's the acquisition of a trade secret by improper means, or disclosure, or use of a trade secret. So acquisition, improperly, disclosure, or use are the three big ones. Acquisition by improper means, perhaps not so surprisingly, has taken on an increasingly important role in proving up misappropriation when you talk about the realm of one who uploads the information to a thumb drive, emails it out of the company. Depending on what that computer use and policy says, maybe that was improper means or not, and depending on which side of the V you're on, you might be arguing different things, of course. But again, it just underscores the importance of really having tight, clean policies that will help you best defend or prosecute one of these claims. Next slide, please. Threatened misappropriation. This is, in some respects, unique to trade secret law or the trade secret statutes. This, again, is from California, but there are many other jurisdictions that recognize threatened misappropriation. So this is where someone has trade secret information in their possession and has engaged in conduct such that it appears they pose an imminent threat of actually using or disclosing or doing something improper with those trade secrets that are wrongfully possessed. And these numbered subpoints here come from the Central Valley case and provide the factual circumstances under which one can make this threatened misappropriation claim. The last little green arrow there just notes that the Central Valley Court didn't hold this, but very clearly left open the possibility that it may be sufficient if, in the context, for example, of an employee who quits and goes to a new employer, if that employee possesses those trade secrets and acquired them improperly and has, by virtue of being at an employer that does similar things as the employer that they just left, that in and of itself may be grounds to get an injunction under threat and misappropriation. Next slide, please. What is not misappropriation? And this is statutory, again, from the California Act, but it is in many of the other jurisdictions. Reverse engineering or independent derivation alone is not considered an improper means. So what that means is if you have something that someone can look at your device, take it apart, and see how it ticks, and copy it, essentially, you've lost any ability to go after that person or entity for trade secret misappropriation. That's not going to be the case in the context of a patent. Independent or reverse engineered derivation of a thing covered by a valid patent may still constitute patent infringement. Next slide, please. So this is that case that I had referred to when looking at that pie crust cartoon. It's a recent case where Intel was a defendant, and I won't read this to you, but there are these excerpts here from the judge who wrote the opinion. And the point is that Intel had purchased some software that apparently, allegedly, was derived in part from misappropriated source code used to create the product. And Silvaco had gone after Intel for misappropriation. And you can see what the court has said about that. Query whether, in the context of patent infringement, if the facts had been just slightly different, whether Intel would have gotten off the hook. Next slide, please. Remedies. Again, from the California Act, but very similar. Actual damages, unjust enrichment, reasonable royalty, punitive damages up to two times actual damages, and attorney's fees. These are not necessarily mutually exclusive, but they can be. For instance, a royalty, frankly, is not very often used. The court has discretion in the context where actual damages can't actually be proved to impose a reasonable royalty. And in the context of attorney's fees, that cuts both ways, where you have a willful infringer who's really engaged in some bad conduct to misappropriate the trade secret, those attorney's fees may be available to prosecute that claim. On the other hand, if you bring a misappropriation claim in bad faith that's not factually supported, the plaintiff may be on the hook for defendant's fees. Next slide, please. So injunctive relief, this is huge in the trade secret context. It's huge because there is an immediacy of getting the trade secret back. It can't be out there. You want to shut the other party's use down and to go as quickly as possible to get that back and make sure that your adversary, your competitor, in most instances, doesn't make use of it. The last little bullet point down here is that circumstantial evidence can be used and often is used and is critical, particularly where computers are used to affect the misappropriation, to prove up the misappropriation claim. Next slide. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide, but this is just an instance in which injunctive relief was granted, where you had an executive going from one company to another. And in this instance, this executive was the only employee, one of seven, that knew the recipe to Thomas's English muffins. And in the category of big business, according to the opinion, the Thomas's line of product had annual revenues of $500 million a year. So serious stuff in the business context, and where the trade secret misappropriation, and in this case threatened misappropriation, was used to prevent this particular employee from joining a competitor. Next slide, please. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Brian to start to work through our factual scenarios.
Okay, thank you, Julie.
Just before we go on, this is Dan Schwartz. I need to read this for the people seeking CLE credit, so bear with me. To receive CLE credit for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form that you will receive following the webinar. Please submit the form to the person indicated on that form. The code is SS1622. I'll say that one more time. The code is SS1622.
All right. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Jim. We're going to launch into a discussion of a couple of scenarios that we think will help illustrate the concepts here and the notion of patent, trade secret, or both from the standpoint of considering protection mechanisms in an intellectual property scheme. The point you should take from this is that they are not mutually exclusive, that there may be situations and development efforts that will involve and can involve both patents and trade secrets. In some situations, patents may be more appropriate. In other situations, trade secret may be more appropriate. So in the first fact pattern here, we're dealing with an electronics manufacturer situation, and some brilliant engineers developed an improvement for a component that's capable of increasing data transmission rates. And it's an improvement that's based on some old components and involves really a couple of things, a selection or new arrangement of circuit components within the device itself that helps increase data rates, but it also involves some firmware or some software that can be installed on the device that helps optimize transmission and facilitates greater data rates. At the same time the development process was going on, they were considering how to manufacture the component, and there were improvements made that related to not just this improved component, but potentially to other components, the first generation of components, a second generation components, and future components. And that particular process involved basically moving some things around so that the process was streamlined, and it involved placing materials in a way that ultimately was not discernible, so that the component would be made much more efficiently and in a way that reduced raw materials and the time to manufacture. A significant consideration for this fact pattern is that the folks who buy these components, cell phone manufacturers in this example, generally don't need to get into your factory to see how you're making your components, or to the extent you have to allow them access, you can allow them limited access to see your process. Next slide, please. So in the context of this example, when it comes to patent considerations with respect to the component, new component, again, it's an improvement to an article of manufacture. The old components are known, so there's a fair bit of information about them that's likely available. They're will be a way, likely in the context of either destructive or non-destructive reverse engineering, to analyze the selection and arrangement of the components so that they will be or may be discernible to someone who wants to reverse engineer. So under the circumstances, it looks like the component may make a good candidate for seeking patent protection, assuming certain things, assuming that it's core to the business, it's going to help expand revenues in one way or another. Either the old product line will continue on and you'll make more money off it, or it'll provide a new revenue stream. And again, assuming that analysis determines that the revenue expected from the increased sales or what have you is going to exceed the cost of the patent process. And again, assuming, as I alluded to earlier, that the product life cycle of this component is likely to exceed the patent application process, so that the component is still going to be here, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the road for you to make revenue off of. In this particular scenario, with respect to the new component, trade secret probably is not a good option because the structure, again, can be reverse engineered, so it would be difficult to maintain that as a trade secret. However, this also illustrates the reality that in certain developments, you may have aspects of the development that can be maintained as trade secrets. And in this case, we used the firmware to illustrate that point. The component will contain firmware that enhances data rates, but we get enhanced data rates out of the selection and arrangement. So we could write a patent application that doesn't necessarily disclose the firmware. As Dan talked about earlier, there is a need to disclose the best mode, but as long as we don't claim the firmware and don't disclose the firmware, well, as long as we don't claim the firmware, we don't have to disclose the firmware. And if it was a question about whether or not we are violating the provision that requires us to disclose the best mode, we can take some comfort in the fact that the new law, the Patent Reform Act or the America Invents Act, no longer allows people attacking patents to attack them on the basis that the best mode was not disclosed. So again, in this particular scenario, the new component presents probably a good candidate for, an excellent candidate for patent protection, not so good for trade secret protection. Next slide, please. And I'll just talk very quickly about the process. There was a process involved here that was also developed at the same time. This may be a better candidate for trade secret protection that would provide potential protection well beyond the 20-year patent term that's available. You wouldn't have to disclose the process as long as you weren't pursuing a patent. You wouldn't have to disclose the particular arrangement of materials that's not discernible. And ultimately, you could, assuming reasonable steps were taken to preserve the secrecy, implement trade secret protection indefinitely. Dan's going to take a deeper dive into other considerations relating to the selection or process protection. Next slide. Dan?
Thank you. We were just coming off mute to make sure we weren't overstepping anybody. So, thanks, Brian. I'm going to take a deeper dive on that process issue in the context of fact pattern number 2, which you'll see up on your screen. Here, we're no longer dealing with an electronics manufacturer. We're dealing with a vendor to the medical industry and to manufacturers providing purified and distilled chemical compositions. Big industry where the purity and quality of the chemicals and raw materials provided is extremely important. For the fact scenario, there are few competitors that have similar capabilities. There are, at least for our purposes of interest here, two primary reasons. First is the large capital investment that it acts as a barrier to entry. You can't just build these production lines to make these purified chemicals very easily. There's a lot of technical know-how that goes into that. And then also there are stringent, in our fact scenario, our hypothetical, there are stringent regulatory and quality assurance requirements. You can imagine, obviously, in the pharmaceutical or chemical world, knowing that you're getting the chemicals that you need would require stringent regulatory and quality assurance requirements. The new idea that we discussed earlier, the new invention here, relates to a new process that the engineers created for purifying the chemical compounds. So with that as the kind of background of the hypothetical, we'll turn to some of the patent considerations. You'll see we've laid them out here. And this is kind of on the process side, which you'll see differs from the component side. First, you've got to take into account as you're addressing any of these issues the financial impact of the invention. Is this an area where the new process is simply reducing expenses? I referred to it as an internal-facing issue. Brian's referred to it the same way as whether or not it's discernible to others, meaning would others, such as your competitors, see the same value out of learning about this new process? If the answer is yes, they would, well, then that leans toward protecting it via patent protection, keeping it secret so that they do not learn of it. But that will also be impacted by the rest of the considerations. The cost and time of seeking patent protection. As we talked about earlier, I think Brian mentioned that it can be years between the time of filing an application and actually obtaining patent protection, whereas that's not necessarily true on the trademark, on the trade secret side, where as long as you keep it secret, it will be a trade secret from the outset and will not there will not be any issues of the time and temporal constraints over it. So if the process that you're dealing with is one that's going to only have a short window of time before the next process supersedes it, or the market for the materials made from that process only has a limited time, well, then you're potentially thinking more on the trade secret side than the patent side, because by the time you got that patent, it might not be worth as much as it was during the time that it had remained secret. The next bullet point discusses the ability to reverse engineer. And I'm going to use two somewhat kind of famous examples as we talk about this. If it is able to be reverse engineered, and I think all three of us now have mentioned this, it is better to seek patent protection. And I'll make this explicit. If somebody else can take what you've done as something new and figure it out for themselves, well, then you don't have the not generally known factor that Jim talked about with respect to trade secret protection, and that anybody who can figure it out is able to use it. On the flip side, there is no requirement in the patent laws that independent development, independent derivation protects you from patent infringement. If you come up with a brand new widget and somebody else, that you get a patent over, and somebody else comes up with it on their own, they can still be liable for patent infringement based on, even though they independently developed it. Two famous examples, I reference one here, the Coca-Cola formula. It's a very famous formula in the sense that no one's been able to reverse engineer it, and the people who actually know the formula for Coca-Cola, you know, kind of like the president and the vice president never traveled together, never seen together, those people from Coca-Cola do not travel together, at least that's the popular press behind it, because they don't want anything to happen to that formula, but nobody has been able to figure it out, and because it's not reverse engineerable, they have never sought patent protection, even though it is one of the, Coca-Cola has been around the world for many, many, many years. No one's been able to replicate it. It's one of the best-held trade secrets out there. Similarly, and I'll bring it a little bit more up to date, is algorithms for Google search engines. They actually have conferences and seminars where they bring in computer scientists who try and crack the algorithms of Google. If Google ever sought patent protection over some of that stuff, they would have to disclose it to the world, but they figured out that it is worth more to keep those processes, maybe like the purification process here, as a secret. The next bullet point, I want to just touch on this quickly, is the new patent reform legislation actually addresses the issue of when you keep certain processes trade secret versus seeking patent protection. There had been a concern before over the so-called prior use defense, which served as a defense to an allegation of infringement. I'll just do this quickly, where even if you came up and were using something on your own, a process in your own facility that somebody else got a patent on after you had been using it, under the old patent laws, you could still be liable for patent infringement. There was a minor modification that allowed you to assert a prior use defense several years back with respect to business method patents. So if you were practicing a business method before somebody else got a patent on that business method, you were able to assert that as a defense to patent infringement. Well, the new America Invents Act, The new patent reform legislation now applies to any invention, such that if you had created something, some process, some method of doing something prior to, and used it in a commercial sense, prior to somebody obtaining patent protection, you can now rely on that as a defense to a charge of patent protection. So while there had been this notion that you wanted to get some of your internal processes out to patent applications before because of the fear that someone else would come and patent them and then sue you for them later, that has been addressed by this very recent act just signed by President Obama on the 16th of September. So that is an area where trade secret protection may be more appropriate due to the limited patent infringement exposure or the seeking to limit patent infringement exposure. Next slide, please. With respect to any of these complex processes like chemical formulations and things of that nature, you have to consider in the decision whether to patent whether or not you will be able to enforce that patent, because you will need to find out what your competitors are doing from a procedural standpoint in order to even allege infringement. So there can be problems with obtaining evidence of infringement to establish infringement where you're talking about people's internal processes. And if you can't figure out from what you see publicly whether or not what they're doing behind the scenes, whether or not that infringes, then it suggests that maybe you go the trade secret route, but it's something that you need to consider. We talked a little bit before briefly about the validity attacks on patents. Your patents will be presumed valid such that when others come back and say, oh, everybody had been doing this before and this, that, and the other thing about this technology is all old, you are entitled to that presumption of validity, presuming that the Patent and Trademark Office did its job. And that it is a substantial burden for the alleged infringer to establish that your patent is invalid. On the damages and the relief side, you would have to prove actual damages. There are floors that Brian talked about earlier. You will get no less than a reasonable royalty, but in appropriate circumstances where you're dealing with maybe a two-competitor market, the ability to obtain the alleged infringer's lost profits based on your own lost profits is definitely available to you. And there are enhanced damages for willful infringement. So just briefly on this, we've talked a lot about going out and trying to reverse engineer something. On the patent side, if you go out and intentionally take what somebody else has done and you do it willfully and blindly to their patent rights, you can get up to treble damages. And when you start talking about tens and hundreds of millions of dollars, you're talking about big, big, big bucks that are very substantial damages awards. On the injunctive relief side, it is more likely in the direct competitor litigation scenario that you would obtain an injunction, and you have to deal with the scope of the injunction to make sure that it's limited to the scope of the patent. And those are all things that you would consider. I'm going to turn it over to Jim for the final thoughts on the trade secret side here.
All right. Thanks, Dan. I'll move through this quickly in the interest of time. And some of this really Dan and Brian in some respects had touched upon. So reverse engineering, is it possible or probable to maintain the invention, the information secret such that it's going to be protectable and maintainable as a trade secret? As to this purification process, is it centralized in a well-controlled production or is it more diffuse? Decentralized or international production can pose challenges. Obviously, it happens every day and it's done, but, for example, what if production occurs in a country with no or very unsophisticated trade secret law? Patents are well-established internationally with varying degrees of enforceability, mind you, but nonetheless are more ubiquitous. Is any of the information that's fundamental and integral to this process kept in the cloud computing? There's the next slide that we'll talk about very quickly. As far as systems, processes, and controls to access, disclosure, and use, you have to think about and be very careful to consider the upstream and downstream considerations, vendors and suppliers. Are you taking appropriate steps to make sure that those folks, those businesses, those entities have appropriately agreed to maintain as confidential all of the information that falls within the ambit of your trade secret information? Then, finally, the desirability of maintaining something secret. From a financial perspective, in the short and long term, is the company going to maintain and achieve more revenues through trade secret or patent protection? On the one hand, you may have your Thomas's English Muffin recipe that you want to absolutely maintain as secret, because if you disclosed it, those $500 million a year are eventually going to be out in the public realm. On the other hand, if there's something that is easily reverse engineered, you're going to want to obviously have your purification process put into the patent context. Next slide, please. So I will quickly go through these, but particularly as it pertains to trade secrets in the cloud, you just have to take some steps that are appropriate to make sure that your secrecy of the information is maintained. Cloud computing is huge. It's an extremely valuable service. It's a great business model. There are just things that you need to do to make sure your trade secret is appropriately taken care of. Sharing can be a problem. Cyber attacks, they can happen for entities like companies or the cloud computer alike, but need to be very careful about that. Data ownership, any modifications or access by the host or provider that are inappropriate or out of the ordinary. What if the cloud provider has employees that post certain information that they ought not do? The continuity of access to data, survival provisions, withholding of data for failure to pay, transitioning or moving data to a new cloud provider. And there can be sticky considerations for jurisdiction and e-discovery when you talk about remote access and use and disclosure of trade secret and related information, particularly in the litigation context when we're talking about cloud computing. And with that, I think we are at the end of our presentation.
Several people submitted questions to us online. Due to the time, we were only able to respond to a few of them online. We will work to respond to the remaining questions separately offline and go from there. And I believe that you can continue to submit questions for another couple of minutes, as I understand it from the technical folks. So please do so if you have any questions, and I believe that wraps it up from our end. Thank you very much.